Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this program is World Watchers. It's program number 738, January the 27th, 1986. All through the years, those months go so fast, I just get in a state of shock when I see, oh boy, it's the end of 1 month, 11 more to go in the end of the year. It goes so fast these days. I wonder if it does. I'm sure it does for you the way it does around here. There's going to be a four-day conference in Monterey, California. A listener to World Watchers sent me this brochure. It's going to be at the Hyatt Regency in Monterey, a four-day financial. It's called a financial conference. Of course, it's a Cold War propaganda activity put on by an institution by Bill Kennedy, president of the Western Monetary Consultants Incorporated. And it's for advice and investment and intelligence briefing, $100 for the 4 days to attend it. The chairman is Bill Kennedy. He's president of Western Monetary Consultants. He's co-author of a Taxpayer's Survey of the Grace Commission report. And he is the chairman of this particular event and the institution, Western Monetary Consultants. A woman who is going to participate in the conference that's of particular interest is Kathy McDonald, described in the brochure that was sent to me, or the pamphlet, the widow of the late Congressman Larry McDonald. Mrs. McDonald worked closely with her husband for many years and is continuing his international efforts to oppose the financing of communism. Mrs. McDonald will discuss the principles that Larry McDonald defended until his murder at the hands of the communists, the principles of putting a $100,000 computer as chairman of Western Goals and the head of the Birch Society into the police departments, specifically Los Angeles, and they're probably in every major police department in the city, putting the names of people who committed no crime but attended events that it was their right to participate in, and thereby therefore became an enemy of the state. Howard Phillips, chairman of the Conservative Caucus, will be here, part of a grassroots lobbying organization. They say based in Vienna, Georgia. Every time I hear or see the Vienna, I think of Elaine Von Damm. It's like Jerry Falwell being at Lynchburg, Virginia. And I think of the Klan. Vienna suits Mr. Howard Phillips properly. Another speaker is Major General George J. Keegan, Jr., the world's most knowledgeable authority on strategic affairs and the Soviet Union. He resigned as chief of the U.S. Air Force Intelligence in 1977 to alert Americans about Soviet military threat. He takes the circuit. He does a lot of lecturing, and he's on a lot of these organizations, and they'll tell you about coming terrorism in America, no place to hide, and that's why Larry McDonald and these various people involved even in with this organization, J. Peter Grace's friend, Mr. Milliken, his partner, helped set up Western Goals and John Reese with the funds for the front organization for the military anyway. And those computers will have the list of people who would be rounded up in case there were problems in this country. And, of course, with John Singlob's Robert Brown and the Soldiers of Fortune and so forth, they will be coming through the towns and cities and containing the terrorism, the leftist terrorism, using the data banks of Western Goals. So they're going to tell you there's no place to hide, and that's true. There's no place to hide from these people when it all comes down. The communists aren't going to knock on our door and take us away. It's going to be these people that are going to take us away, and now they're going to discuss terrorism in America. I usually go down to L.A. that week. I don't think I'll be able to visit that conference. It's $100. It's pretty expensive, but that's the week in March, my mother's birthday, so I don't think I'll be able to attend. If you want to come to Monterey and hear these people and see them, you can, and the location will be the Hyatt Regency in Monterey. I want to just discuss a few things about Martin Luther King, because I left off last week and wanted to call attention to a few articles and a few items before we go on to other material. There's one in the San Francisco Chronicle, January 21st, Unkept Promise at King Death Site, and it's about the Lorraine Motel that was bought in 1982. They were going to tear it down. That's where Martin Luther King was murdered, and it was bought for $144,000, and they call it the Lorraine Civil Rights Museum, And they're trying to raise money to make it into an educational center and a museum for people in Memphis, Tennessee. And they haven't been able to do it. So in the meantime, they're using it. It's being used as a horror house. And the ladies of the night or the day, whichever way you want, stream in and out. And there's just no way to maintain this place. It's all run down and pretty much of a disgrace. The article says, in room 306, where King was staying on April 4th, 1968, has been turned into a glass-enclosed shrine. The space is shared with memorabilia from Lorraine Bailey, the motel manager, who suffered a cerebral hemorrhage after learning of King's death and died of a heart attack the next day. Martin Luther King was supposed to stay at another hotel. I forget whether it was the Howard Johnson or the Sheraton, one of them, a more well-known, of course, white hotel where many of the whites stayed. And then he was told and directed to go to the Lorraine Motel because he was going to lead some strikes there in Memphis, Tennessee, and he better be where the black people are so that he appears to be one of them. He was one of them, definitely, but they wanted to stay at this hotel. And it was whoever coaxed him to stay at that hotel was setting him up, in fact, for what happened later, because that's where the arrangement was, to have him murdered from that location. And the woman who was in charge of changing the arrangements was dead. Of course, I mentioned last week, Martin Luther King's brother was found drowning. He was in a pool dead. Shortly afterwards, his mother was murdered at the church, sitting at the organ, playing at the organ. Two judges that handled the case both died. Percy Foreman, his CIA attorney, died. And his brother also was one of those that was helping make the change of arrangements, who was at the Lorraine Motel, as well as Jesse Jackson and Andrew Young. They go on to say that it's a shame they don't have the money to do it. It's a shame that on the other side of town, you have the Graceland Mansion for Elvis Presley, the king of rock and roll. On this town, you have this hole in the wall for the king of civil rights, where prostitutes leave the motel after daybreak, and the clientele of men in pickup trucks and Cadillacs are replaced by station wagons and families, and then in the evening it's just filled again with the women in the cars pulling up. And they made the comparison of Graceland across the street, one king, and then the shabby, terrible, disheveled place of the other king, leaving that kind of memory. And it's hard to think when you saw all the money spent and the celebrations and the bronze statue and all the things that went on, that people wouldn't have consideration to put a fund into that particular hotel. There's another article in LA Times that about a speech of Jesse Jackson. Last week I made a mistake, and I don't make too many of them, but I had, in fact, very seldom do I see something that retracts my original feelings about this matter. I hadn't read, among all the articles, and maybe it was too soon, obviously it was, the statements of Jesse Jackson and a few others regarding the murder of Martin Luther King. And the LA Times had a story, January 21st, they tell about George Bush getting a thunderous ovation from people at the audience when he went down to Atlanta, Georgia, for the celebration. I keep calling it a celebration. The birthday, I guess it was a celebration for a lot of people. It was to remember his birthday, and I think that George Bush, the former director of the CIA, a very wealthy man, a millionaire himself, can come down and give a speech. And then, of course, there is that shabby hotel that everyone ignores. Bush was there getting a standing ovation, and some remained unconvinced of his sincerity, it says. But then there was another description of a speech of Jesse Jackson, also on the CBS Morning Show. Early in the day, the Reverend Jesse Jackson charged, "The jury is not in yet," on whether the government was behind King's assassination. Appearing on CBS Morning News, Jackson said, this was in New Orleans, "We know he was character assassinated by our government. As to whether or not he was physically assaulted by them, the question is still out. I mean, the jury is not yet in on that." In Washington, FBI duty officer Jeff Maynard and Justice Department spokesman Terry Eastland said they had no comment on Jackson's remarks. James Earl Ray is serving a 99-year sentence after he pleaded guilty. Now, the Los Angeles Herald had a story January the 20th Convicted killer James Earl Ray insists he was only a pawn. Ray says that the government officials, including Percy Forman, the late Percy Forman, who was a CIA attorney, forced him to plead guilty. Ray claimed he was the pawn in a conspiracy to kill King. He was framed by a man known as Rowell. Of course, he had Bernard Fensterwald, another CIA attorney, on his side. Ha ha, you see what good it did. And Mr. Haynes, another CIA attorney, and of course, Mark Lane, the four of them. And it doesn't look like Ray will get out with those people around him. I doubt if he ever will get out. He says that he wanted to write a book on this subject, and he's calling it The Rule of Law, They Say. That's the title of the book. He wants a publisher because he can't get this out in a court of law, and he wants a foreign publisher because no American publisher would treat him fairly. There are many people who write books, such as, Vicki Morgan, who got her head cracked open with a baseball bat. I could cite endless people who think, now I have a book, I can tell a story. The minute the book comes out, they're dead. That is the end of them. Mr. Butcher, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, the man who did the investigative work on the Korea Gate story, did a book on Reverend Moon and that organization. And it wasn't too long afterwards before people even really knew about the book that he went flying out of a window in New York City and was dead. It's a very hard way to tell the world. The world doesn't care to know, or they could go and open up the committee again. And, of course, he's in a very dangerous position being in jail. And James Earl Ray thinks, or maybe is being coaxed, you know, to write a book. And then that will be the excuse for somebody to come in, and he certainly isn't going to get this story out. The article said after a three-year investigation, the Congress, this is the Congressional Select Committee on Assassinations, concluded in 1979 that Ray killed Martin Luther King. But they said there was substantial evidence to establish the existence of a St. Louis conspiracy, and that did, in fact, finance the assassination. The congressional panel criticized the Justice Department and the FBI for spying on Martin Luther King and for failing to investigate the possibility of a conspiracy for his murder. Even though Ray admitted that he bought the gun and rented the room, the gun was part of a gun-running scheme and went to Rowell, and Ray was several blocks away when Martin Luther King was killed. And then for those of you that don't remember, he went on to Canada and to Portugal and to London, Canada, London, to Portugal, back to London, and was arrested on his way down to Africa. Another story in the Los Angeles Herald, they did quite a good amount of work on this. There was a news conference, they reported, before a lot of people were there giving speeches before the main event, the Saturday evening and the Sunday, finalizing the Martin Luther King birthdays. Political leaders got together in California, including the State Assembly Speaker Willie Brown, Congressman Mervyn Dimely, and Assemblyman Maxine Waters. Dr. King was assassinated, said Jesse Jackson, and they quoted him with another quote in the same article, saying the government was implicated. He said FBI memos said that their role was to disrupt, discredit, destroy the black leader. It was to stop the black messiah. It was the role of Dr. King, who became a national security threat because of his charisma, and they referred to him as messiah. And as I say, Jesse Jackson and Andrew Young could stay in line. They were the ones that were supposed to be the heirs to the messiah of Martin Luther King. King couldn't be compromised the way the other men are compromised. And I doubt that he would travel around with people like Louis Farrakhan, who were meeting with Mr. Metzger of the Nazi Party and the Klan. This same article in the Herald said James Earl Ray possessed neither the IQ nor the acumen to kill King, and to get out of the country, the government had to be helping him with these various roles and in covering up. And I mentioned this last week, this thing about Merv Dimely. December the 17th, 1986, the end of the year, there was a story, Korean Rally Welcomes Reverend Moon. This is the Reverend Moon, funded by Ryosha Sasakawa, who was the guest of honor of Mrs. King, the Reverend Moon of Causa, the death squads in South America, Central America, Nicaragua, Guatemala, where the killing is still going on, even though there's a new president, and El Salvador supporting the police establishment there. and funds millions and millions of dollars in South America trying to put back the dictatorship, the Nazi, really, literally Nazi dictatorship in Argentina, and to overthrow Brazil again, and to fund dictators, right-wing people in Bolivia and Paraguay, Uruguay, and so forth. That's Mr. Ryosha Sasakawa with Reverend Moon. And when Reverend Moon went back to Korea and got out of jail for his financial dealings, which were very minor compared to what he really is in, he went back to Korea, and he was accompanied by Representative Merv Dimely of California. The Reuters article said, speaking at the rally in South Korea, where there were 25,000 people, an anti-communist rally, was Representative Merv Dimely, California Democrat, who thanked Reverend Moon for his efforts to bring freedom to Korea. There is no greater strength to fight communism than one belief in the power of the Christian Church. That's Merv Dimely, the black representative in California, who also was very thick with Jim Jones, who was running a mind control experiment station, and you know the rest of that business down in Jonestown. Merv Dimely traveling with Reverend Moon, praising the Christian control of democracy in South Korea. And South Korea is a place where if you're a student and get protesting on your mind, you get your head cracked with a baseball bat. That's a whole country of Marvin Pancos who just crash people's heads open. There is very little freedom in the Christian country that he's talking about, and certainly no elections and no chance to speak out in South Korea. But it's a good Christian country for Merv Dimely, for Reverend Moon, for Ryosha Sasakawa and his Japanese mafia connections, gun running, and so forth. And then these people participated in remembering Martin Luther King as if they could be identified and of the same ilk as King if they helped in this celebration. One of the most disgusting articles of this whole event was January the 12th in the Washington Post. It was written by Kathy Sawyer. Atlanta commemoration limited by a tight budget, but enthusiasm was plentiful in the grand parade. There was a budget projection of $1.5 million for the Martin Luther King holiday in Atlanta and so forth, but they had to make do with $400,000, including $300,000 raised from private sources. Maybe that's Ryosha Sasakawa also. And the parade in Atlanta, Georgia, was put together by some very interesting, I say interesting, tongue-in-cheek. The article says the organizers of the amalgam that includes conservative Republicans and corporate chiefs as well as civil rights veterans seem determined to make up in enthusiasm what they lacked in money. Everyone rallied for the day, and actually, why did they have to put any money, a large amount, into it? They could have fixed up the Lorraine Motel and used the money for better ways. I believe they should have. They don't ever call me on those matters. Now, regarding the parade in Atlanta, Colonel Jack T. Downey, 3rd Army Chief of War Plans, one of the many federal officials and staff on loan to the King Holiday Commission, he directs the Atlanta office. Wouldn't Martin Luther King be killed by a group with war plans? Of course he was. The Permandex operation, the team that set him up, was a Defense Department, just as it was John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. But here is a man who followed Mahatma Gandhi's beliefs, believed in nonviolence, and to commemorate his birthday, they had the 3rd Army Chief of War Plans leading the parade and heading the parade. Then the article goes on, among the varied VIP expected in the next week are Senator Ted Edward Kennedy and Secretary of Education William J. Bennett. That is so obscene. All you have to do is think of what Bennett says about the blacks, about the black children in schools, his racism, his coaxing people into Christian, white Christian colleges and getting tax benefits for the private schools so they don't have to go to school with blacks. He would set the blacks back 100 years, and he was part of the celebration to be, it was ready to take place. Edward Kennedy voted for the Graham-Rudman bill. Wait and see how that affects particularly the blacks in the next years, as many of the opportunities and advantages they have are cut by Reagan wanting to fund Star Wars at all costs and dropping the budget, and this man, the Senator Kennedy, And Senator Dole, also who was down there, voted for the Graham Rudman bill. They mentioned Senator Dole going down there and Bishop Desmond Tutu and Vice President Bush. Now, for the corporations, the McDonald Corporation helped produce a film called Happy Birthday, Dr. King, and the American Can Company provided a video. The McDonald's were the company that coaxed the low wages, the minimum wage be dropped, probably, I think it was down around $2 an hour, particularly for students, college students, going working in the summer, and McDonald's hamburgers make their millions and millions out of employing black minorities and so forth, and coaxing the very bottom wage that they can get, the hardest work per hour, not the hardest, but it's not easy work, it's continuous, but the wages, they were the ones who were coaxing, among a few others, for giving these very, very low wages and reaping in prices, the same kind of prices, and students who work in the summer to go to school are at a disadvantage. They could hardly work or save anything for that. They mentioned Albert Davis, a vice president of the Atlanta-based Coca-Cola company, who took time off from work with the King Center on the celebration and was helping out with some of the work, and he said at least some of the problem was political. Some people, he said, had decided that it was politically unwise to give this major support, but he went ahead. Now, Coca-Cola was named in a magazine, National Reporter, as being a conduit of funds for Permandex, for Larry McDonald. Permandex is the operation that was set up after World War II, right immediately after it, to rebuild the German rearmament, to get that off the ground again. And Permandex was the branch formed for the assassination teams that was part of the plan and did kill John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. And Coca-Cola was identified in Atlanta, Georgia, as part of the Permandex operation. And remember, Robert Byron Watson, I wrote about him in my article in Rebel of November 83, on the anniversary of the murder of John Kennedy. And it was about Permandex. And it was Marvin Watson's testimony before the House Select Committee that he worked in a gallery where these men were talking about in the next day, next week rather, they were going to kill Martin Luther King, and they did, in fact, kill him. And they were linked directly to the Permandex operation. So much for the social gathering. They said if the enthusiasm was great, the budget was tight, and all of those people mentioned could have swung the budget even a little better. Now, the Andrew Young was very much a part of the celebration. Of course, you saw him, or the remembrance of the birthdays. And I just want to cite one little article from the Sunday Star Bulletin from Honolulu, September 22nd. It's about South Africa, South African citizenship, apartheid, and how South Africa could learn from the American South and from the Protestant region in which the integration began, thanks to Martin Luther King. And the article says the initiatives of the South African businessman to get together with men from America can be viewed as a hopeful sign in the difficult change ahead of negotiating non-destructive resolution to difficult and complex problems. The critical link between Birmingham and Atlanta is the city's present mayor, Andrew Young, of Atlanta, Georgia, the former U.N. ambassador for Jimmy Carter, who is familiar with the complexities of African politics and economic problem. In 1963, in Birmingham, as a top lieutenant to Dr. Martin Luther King, Young marched in his dungarees in the morning. Then in the evening, he changed to his business suit and met with white business leaders in the afternoon. There he joined Burke Marshall, head of the Civil Rights Division of the Kennedy Justice Department, now a professor of law at Yale University. Marshall won the confidence and respect of the business elite in Birmingham, Alabama, where he spent weeks sitting up and participating in negotiations of a local newspaper publisher who asked that he come to the city. An invitation from South African business elite to Andrew Young and Burke Marshall to share their experiences could prove helpful. It certainly couldn't make matters worse. Now, Burke Marshall is the attorney who was brought in by Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis to, even before she was an Onassis, to keep the lid on all investigations in the archives on the murder of John Kennedy. He was to hold the key that nobody could get certain papers in any of our lifetimes on who killed John Kennedy. That's Burke Marshall. And after Chappaquiddick and Mary Jo Kopechne was killed, drowned there, and Ted Kennedy got to a telephone. He called Burt Marshall immediately. So Burt Marshall holds the family secrets on the murder of John Kennedy, and along with Andrew Young and, of course, Jesse Jackson, they know the house secrets, I suppose, on who killed Martin Luther King. And while they become very prominent and wealthy and conspicuous in all the various sources of media that we have today, they hold the story down on the real truth so that we can find out who did these murders and realize that those people in power today had a part, if not the planning of the murder, at least we know they had a part in covering it up. Now, there's one item that I've been seeing in the news for the past month or 2 months that I've put off discussing with you just for fear I might puke on the air, but I've never done that. But I guess I have to let it out now or I'll burst because I can't fathom anything so horrendous as this. The article is Henry Kissinger Wants to Run for Senate. This was out of the San Francisco Chronicle January 24th, but I have earlier stories. Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger rushed from France to New York by way of the Concorde last night to attend an annual conservative party. Rumors are flying that Kissinger is considering the 1988 run for Senate against Senator Patrick Moynihan. Now, the next step from there in running for Senate is to change the Constitution that a foreign-born can become president of the United States, and Henry Kissinger will be the president of the United States someday. I think that this was decided years and years ago, just as I was saying, 10 years before Ronald Reagan was sworn in his office that he would be president, and I was told over and over again it was impossible that somebody so incompetent and so horrendous could actually be voted president of the United States, and a lot of people assume that other people catch on, but they don't catch on. So Henry Kissinger is part, of course, he's the very conservative group. Phyllis Schlafly wrote a book about him years ago, and the cover was that, you know, he was a Boris, a Jewish spy, a Russian spy, you know, all of these stories combined together, a communist and a Jew, you know, make a perfect enemy as he works his way up into the establishment and secures himself in the establishment, which he has always done. He's a murderer, a mass murderer, a drug dealer. He is one of the most detestable people because of that smile and because people rationalize that charm. I never could see it, but watch out. He'll get the Senate seat if Henry wants it. And just one last item before I go on to, I want to discuss the hearing, the advanced genetic scientist that I worked on last week and went to 8 hours of hearings in Monterey this week, actually today. That one last article in the San Francisco Chronicle I want to share. Neo-Nazis forfeit cash and arsenal. Now, 22 Nazis were charged with racketeering and were arrested up in Seattle. I've mentioned that before. One of them is on the lam. He hasn't been arrested. That leaves 21, and 10 went to trial. So you get a good round figure of 11 that are still out. So the 10 that were convicted, 10 members of the violent Nazi group convicted of racketeering, have agreed to forfeit $400,000 in cash, thousands more in property and weaponry, enough for a small army. They have forfeited this because they've been convicted of the racketeering charges. Then the article goes on, however, the bulk of the more than $4 million that members of the order were accused of taking in bank and armored car robberies have never been found. They were not only accused of it, but they were convicted of these charges of the bank robbery and so forth. The U.S. Attorney Susan Barnes said that the forfeited material would be auctioned off unless it is of use to the government agencies. The guns will be destroyed. Well, you can buy guns like you can buy chickens at a ranch or eggs at a ranch. This is so ridiculous. So after they were convicted on December 30th, one of them, Bruce Pierce of the order, said that he would give up his homes in Roseville, Georgia, $30,000 in cash, a 40-foot mobile home, 69 grenades, dynamite, a machine gun, 7 pistols, and it lists his belongings, a crossbow, a metal tomahawk, and they would give up a CB radio, two-way radio. Gary Yarbrough would give up $35,000 in cash, a motorcycle, and vehicles. Now, why did, it names a few of them and what they had to give up. Why, I don't understand why they just didn't say, stay in jail forever, go to the clink, or tell us where the $4 million went, who got it. and then take it back from those people and arrest them for receiving stolen property, which they know is a law. They could abide by that law, handing it out to other factions of Nazi and Klan and Posse around the country. I really don't understand how this works, but the U.S. Attorney's Office obviously works in collusion with these organizations, whereby they pick up a few belongings and let the organization keep its cash. We'll take a one-minute break now, and then I'm going on to the matter of the hearing at the Board of Supervisors today, the meeting on the genetic mutation of bacteria for spreading agriculturally in the Salinas Valley in Monterey County.